You talk about one match shows. I have never
in billing. This one is
WrestleMania 12 is probably. I mean, the we talk about Hogan Warrior WrestleMania 6. Obviously, this did not have the star power of that, but
right.
Given what was underneath, which wasn't much,
right,
and that you knew the amount of time these guys were going to be given, 60 minutes,
right.
I mean, this is the definition of one match show. I mean, again, you take your two top guys, both baby faces. Put them against each other. You don't leave much on the undercard. Now, the difference between this and WrestleMania 6 is obviously this is only half the matches. And,
right.
And Brett and Shawn go an hour as opposed to 20 minutes. But, and the undercard matches get more time than they did back in 90. But.
Right. And Shawn Michaels appearing in this match, challenging Bret Hart for the championship, winning it at an hour and a minute and 52 seconds. They went to overtime since there was no fall in the first hour, which that's a curious decision for an Iron Man match.
Yeah, I don't understand why they did it.
It was
some people say
to set up the controversy of the overtime. Clearly, I think
I didn't like that. I'm gonna say something about first of all. Most people or most lists or analysis of this match, I generally view that most people either overrate this match or underrate this match. I think this match is both underrated and overrated by most people.
That.
Where, to me, from a rating perspective, I give it 4.5 stars, making it one of the, you know, when you take a look at...
Oh, that's still, that's higher than I thought you were going to say. Okay.
Okay. When you take a look at the first 12 WrestleManias, that's top five. Okay, the only matches that get... of the first 12 WrestleManias, the only five matches that get at least 4.5 stars, Savage Steamboat.
Mm-hmm.
Savage Warrior.
Okay.
Oh, that's six, actually. I'm sorry, I miscounted. Math was never my strong suit. Savage Flair gets 4.75.
Mm-hmm.
The two from WrestleMania 10 get 5 stars.
Okay.
So there's 5 right there, and this would be 6.
Okay.
So this is one that when it went down, this was the 6th best match in WrestleMania.
I can understand
history.
The confusion on the numbers. This is an ounces on a scale, so
yes,
I can understand
yes,
that.
Yes, thank you. Yes, Cuban B.
Very nice.
Yes, very nice, Cuban B.
Thank you.
But to me, I don't like the booking of the no falls in an hour. To me, you should, and we'll get to this in a minute. But at the end of the day, it's still the two best workers of the period, mm-hmm. two of the best of all time, doing their thing for an hour. You know what I'm saying? Now, I think, and I guess maybe they thought they had to because it was such a short card. I think, considering the way it played out,
mm-hmm.
I think they should not have done an Iron Man match. They should have, what they should have done is just announce a match.
Uh-huh.
Have it go the hour time limit, and do overtime.
How could you have built in the demand for overtime sans Iron Man? How do you if it's announced as a 60-minute match and the champion defends by draw?
I don't know what the justification was for doing it with the Iron Man gimmick. To be honest, not to go all Bret Hart on you, but
yeah,
I mean, to me there's no.
True.
To me it's like okay, you're gonna wrestle for 60 minutes, guy at the end with the most falls wins. Well, okay.
Couldn't you just say no time limit then? That would accomplish a lot the same
No,
thing,
because to your point, they obviously wanted to do the kind of the built-in controversy with the overtime.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah. I mean,
So to me, I just think that it would have added more drama because the problem was, and people have talked about this, that the live crowd was not that cool with the gimmick. There were people that were getting up and leaving during
right.
the match because... Look, you and I are different than your average Shpamool in row 33, okay?
Right.
Okay, most, your average fan, even people that I know that really like, it takes us, there aren't a lot of people that want to, the masses, the
right.
mainstream, John Q. Walmart, if you will.
Right.
Does not have a lot of desire to watch an hour wrestling match.
Right.
I thought it was well worked. I just don't like how there was no falls, especially when there were so many spots where there should have been.
I mean, as much as I don't want to admit
they didn't like each other either, which
right.
There always kind of seem to be spots where it's like, I kind of, when I watch this, and I have to admit it's mm-hmm. been a while since I've watched this match, where I remember saying, you know, it if these guys liked each other better, I think that spot would have looked better. You know what I'm
saying?
It
could have been, yeah. The cooperation might not have been there. And again, as
now, they both complimented each other and said, you know, it was a very good. And that's what I said. To me, this was a borderline, you know, this was kind of because of the stage it was at. And
right.
This took match of the year in a lot of the, you know, kind of kayfabe non-observer polls.
Right.
I think, you know, when WWE did a countdown of their best WrestleMania matches, it was, like, right near the top.
Right.
You know, just put it in perspective, I had it sixth best at the time when it would happen.
Right.
Right now it's, like, 13. So it's not. I mean, it's not even a top 10 WrestleMania match.
When you talk about this,
which is
match,
kind of disappointing when you right. consider the participants
and the guys in it, and how guys like me and you look at wrestling versus how the masses do. I mean, I guess the best example would be like for as much as I like, say, for example, you know, the Dragon Gate style. Would I like the WWE better today if it were if you had those great wrestlers like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan or whatever used Dragon Gate style? Sure, I would prefer it. Would it appeal to the masses as much as it does? No, I don't think so. So I think that's the difference. That's the divide. Guys like me and you like something that will never be as popular as the mainstream, you know, reach.
Yeah,
the
I think
style.
I think they were trying to kind of, okay, this is going to be this great match. It just, I just don't think they should have announced it as an Iron. I just don't, like, if you're going to do an Iron Man match, the point of the gimmick is to have multiple falls in the time period.
You know, let me just ask you a little bit of devil's advocate here. How would you have introduced the element of controversy into it? Knowing that you...
I would have done the exact same match.
Okay.
Just without the Iron Man gimmick. I would have just had them go to a 60-minute draw.
Okay.
And have Gorilla Monsoon say there must be a winner, which is what he did anyway.
Wouldn't that be more of a heel move for Monsoon to do than he did in this one, at least with an Iron Man match? You know, there must be a winner. I mean, it's debatable.
No.
But as far as restarting a match where the champion has defended it by draw?
He did anyway. To me, if he would have used the statement, there must be a winner
mm-hmm.
beforehand, you could squeeze it out. Besides, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew Shawn was winning here anyway. So, I mean, it's
pretty much.
Yes.
But the way that they...
By the way, why did Ultimate Warrior say... get the F out of my ring to Hulk Hogan, and by the way, Sean did to Bret here reportedly.
Yeah, that was...
Whereas Sean says, I don't really recall saying that.
Yeah, non-denial.
Yeah.
But the other thing, too, just a note as far as how this was done. And, you know, Shawn Michaels, that they had been doing the build since the fall there. They did the concussion angle with him. He came back at Royal Rumble. He won.
He had all the heat. Bret always claims he was a lame duck champion here, and he was kind of right.
Yeah, he was. He was. But I just look at this whole thing in getting him ready for this. They introduced Sean's longtime real-life mentor, Jose Lothario, as his manager, which I see as it's not as bad as Smiling Diesel, but taking the heartbreak
I hated
kid
Jose
and,
Lothario.
Yeah.
No offense to him. I'm sure he's a very nice man. But,
didn't it work against his character?
Yeah, he...
They were pigeonholing Sean into the same thing as everybody else.
It was, yeah, I mean...
Let's remove what makes Sean Sean and make him more in the mold of traditional WWF babyface world champion.
I don't know if they were... I don't know if you know, they were trying to make, you know, Jose Lothario the Hispanic Arnold Skullender.
Kind of, yeah. That's a great parallel.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
I hate babyface managers as a general rule. I mean, they're usually worthless. Paul Bearer pulled it off, but he was just had one guy. You know, I mean,
Precious Paul could make it work pretty good. It depends. It depends.
But generally, babyfaces don't need managers. Managers are for heels,
right?
That usually
yeah.
can't talk.
Yeah. So you and I agree on that.
So that yeah,
Michaels...
I don't know what that was. I don't know if Sean just wanted that or what. But yeah, I always like. When they dropped Jose Lothario from the storyline,
right.
I was not. I remember several weeks later not being like, oh, you know, what happened to Jose Lothario?
They the high point of the entire Jose Lothario angle was I know later in the year I think they did a thing of Sean or of Sid assaulting him with the camera and everything, and I think his son went to go attend to him in the back.
Pete Lothario, yeah, and then yeah. Sid beat him up too,
and that was.
That they wrote him out basically.
Well,
way.
I'm trying to. I think it was. I think it was Jerry Waller that had the line of, "I understand that's Jose's son, Hose B." Like that is a great line.
Oh, my favorite was at the King of the Ring when Cam Cornette got into it with Sean Warrior and Ahmed Johnson. That real motley crew.
Yes.
Jim Cornette goes, "That no good Jose Lothario pulled a switchblade on me." Jimmy C.
That is awesome. As we start working our way here on
not
the,
much
on
the
undercard
here. This is,
although
from a match perspective, this was obviously
better than last
out,
year.
When you have an out,
and the guys were a little more over by and large than last
some
year,
of this,
relatively
most of this
speaking.
Stuff had programs, and I'll say this: placing this in, this is the very rarely mentioned average WrestleMania range. To me, if you were to line up every the 27 previous WrestleManias, this one might be dead middle.
This is
7 is the only one that has gotten the average designation group so far. This one's slightly better than 7.
I'll say above average just because it, to me, and I place emphasis on this, on the whole, to me, it's a very inoffensive undercard.
You've got a good match, is it disappointing? Maybe. It's not as disappointing as some would say.
Right.
But nothing outright, well... nothing outright sucked on this show,
right.
But I,
We'll get to that.
I thought of something.
We'll hit bullet points on these. This is the only time thus far where I've brought up a dark match / free for all, but because
it
played
in. The first one.
Yeah, well, okay. Well,
this was the very first one they ever did.
All right, well, they did dark matches previously that I didn't reference, but this one was on the free for all that you could watch for free before the pay-per-view on the channel there. I'm only mentioning it because tag team match for the vacant tag team championship, the Body Donnas Skip and Zip with Sonny, defeated the Godwins Henry and Phineas with Hillbilly Jim. At 5:21, the less said about that abortion, the better.
Yeah, the tag team division was just the backdrop for Sonny at this point.
It really was. Camp Cornette, a name which I always just found weird and stupid and indie-rific. I love Jim Cornette, but I don't like the name. It doesn't sound big time to me.
It wasn't really like official, but...
It doesn't sound big time to me. I just don't like it. But his team of... it was a six-man tag. Vader, Owen, Hart, and the British Bulldog... with Cornette defeated Yokozuna, Jake Roberts, and Ahmed Johnson with Mr. Fuji. Just throwing a bunch of guys in there.
I kind of like, it was... 1251. But people were kind of... Yoko would turn face. It didn't work because his weight was becoming a major issue. And no one wanted to work with him. But Ahmed was really over during this period. He would peak a few months after this. Jake obviously kind of was doing the nostalgia thing. He was pretty new.
Right.
I remember kind of thinking that this wasn't bad. I watched it. It's not a bad match, and it's kind of cool that, the heel team won.
They did.
Which was
over.
The right move. Yoko obviously couldn't do the job, and Ahmed shouldn't, so, Jake Roberts,
Let me ask you this. Shades of what we talked about with the previous WrestleMania, the mixed tag match between Savage and Dusty that I thought should have been straight up. You have here potentially the 1993 Dream Match, which you would see ultimately on lesser pay-per-view, Vader and Yoko. That should have been the heads-up match, I think. Just go to Vader and Yoko.
Yeah, they did it, I think, at the next In Your House.
Yeah.
Or was it canceled? Well, you needed to get Ahmed and Jake the payday.
Then do a separate tag match.
Well, would you know what's funny? I think they did that at that Good Friends, but I think that's what they did. They did the Vader Yoko stand.
Yeah, I would have split them off. That's just my preference. The Ringmaster, soon to be known as Steve Austin, with Ted DiBiase, defeated Savio Vega
How much talent he had from the minute they brought him in.
Yes, that's why they were going to call him Ice Dagger.
Yeah, the Ringmaster with Ted DiBiase as a mouthpiece.
Yeah, that's,
with the $1 million title gimmick.
It writes itself, yes.
Not a bad match. This was Austin's first. Well, no, was he the ring? He wasn't the ringmaster here.
According to Wikipedia.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Wikipedia can stick. I believe he was freshly minted Stone Cold Steve Austin. I will have to check the back of my tape.
Okay.
If you'd like to.
And I understand that list, Chili McFreeze of the suggested names, I already mentioned Ice Dagger on there. And I believe that the closest that they came to his eventual name was so-called Steve Austin.
But no, it was cool. Again, it's kind of cool that the right guy goes over.
Yes.
But this was Austin's first feud was with Savio Vega. Savio was kind of like that reliable hand that would always do the job.
Yeah, he was a good worker, but solid mid-card. Ultimate Warrior in a minute 36 defeated Hunter Hearst Helmsley Sable.
Yeah, we shouldn't gloss over this.
Big historical.
Well, first of all, this Wikipedia match. Sometimes I have a problem with this website.
Okay.
Personally, when we you're just doing it for point of reference of the card. With Sable, people are like, well, she was kind of like unnamed at this point. I think they may have said, oh, we understand this woman's name is Sable. Because Triple H was doing something where he was just bringing like a hot broad out with him.
Right.
He was still the snobby. He was still fully. He was still probably new, actually. Right. He was really new, actually.
Right.
No, I take that back. No, this was 95 is when he was really new. But was when he first came in. But
well, they were doing the thing, too. Again, Sable at the time, anyways, Mark Mero's real-life wife. That led to a thing very shortly thereafter where Triple H was kind of roughing her up, giving her a hard time. Mero comes in, comes to her rescue. Sable then transfers to Mero.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think they get into a fight, I think, later in the show. Mero had just signed. He signed a big deal.
Right.
He was very improved. When they got him, he was at his peak, I thought. He was pretty good. I mean, he deserved, I thought, that kind of a shot at that Intercontinental reign. The injuries derailed him, though, and he was never the same, and he was then overshadowed by his wife.
Right. And I'm...
We shouldn't gloss over this Ultimate Warrior return. This was kind of like the other hook they gave.
Right.
That they hoped that to a real desperate attempt to bring him back. And, you know, Triple H was not being punished. The Click incident had not happened yet, obviously.
Right.
So this wasn't punt. He was just the guy, and Warrior comes out. He no-sells the pedigree, which, you know, today would, you know, earn you immediate firing.
Right.
But back then it was just what he was supposed to do. And, yeah, it's funny to see Triple H get this crushed.
It's
funny, but he's much skinnier, by the way.
He was, exactly.
Before Sheamus could work out with him all the time.
By the way, I'm about to make a joke that might indicate that I'm a brave man. I'm not a brave man. I'm only going to make this joke because at this stage of life, if I needed to in self-defense, one good punch to Brock Lesnar's colon would kill him. So that's the only reason I'm going to make this joke. But kids, go out there and Google Sable, sleaze thread, latex, and vegan. I'll leave it at that.
Oh, no, yes.
It's a tremendous story.
But, you know, this was like a big drawing point, and...
Yeah, the return of the Warrior.
And you know, like all Ultimate Warrior returns, it lasted for a couple months, and he started no-showing, and they fired him.
Yeah, it went nowhere. In terms of star power...
Yeah, he was feuding with Jerry Lawler 2 months later.
Right.
Over a piece of art.
Yeah, and wearing a ball cap so as not to get glass in his hair when he gets hit with a frame, which was a wimp move.
Are you for serious?
Yeah, Lawler talks about that in his book.
God, you read a lot of books.
I'll have to loan it to you. Well, it was also, I take it you never watched the Ultimate Burial of the Ultimate Warrior or whatever they call their DVD. All right, Lawler talks about it on there. That
you have
the
to
Warrior
remember
came,
my state of, you know, Iowa.
Warrior came out there in a ball cap, and Waller was like, oh, crap. Angle alert. The guy's wearing a ball cap, and he's never worn one before with a ponytail, no less. But it was a thing where he didn't trust, because Waller was telling him, look, the only thing I'll say in defense of the Warrior is that is one of those things where somebody can give you all the assurances you want, but how do you know you're not going to get glass in your eye or anything like that?
But I mean, look, it's an odd job you're signing up for, man.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll give you
okay,
that.
Okay, you don't want to get hit in the head with glass? You know, become a used car salesman.
Well, not only that, you know, I mean, if it's me at the time when I know the frame is swinging, I'm closing my eyes already, there are things you can do to kind of protect yourself. On that.
Yeah, I remember him wearing a ball cap and me being like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And then, you know.
Hit the bricks, Jim Helwig.
Exactly. And then he's got to act like the shot phased him. The last two matches we haven't talked about here had a pretty decent amount of star power for that time. Undertaker in what was to be the beginning of the end of Diesel defeated him, got his revenge in 1646 in a singles match.
I was hip to the internet at this point. I was plugged in. The old AOL, and I was in chat rooms. I knew at this point that he was leaving. I thought this was good, and I remember I thought this was going to be it. Like, I thought this was going to be the mother of all burials.
Attention list serve members. Yeah. Kevin Nash has signed with WCW.
You know, yeah. And it's just like, I thought this was going to be like the, I thought they were going to, like, you know, put him in a body, like, and it turned out that, and this it was. I always thought it was curious, and I'm glad they didn't do it because they did do it because it was his best match ever by far.
Yeah,
the Good Friends Better Enemies match was Shawn out the door, but yeah, Undertaker goes over. I mean, everyone that was plugged into what was going on behind the scenes knew Undertaker was going to go over. quite huge. Diesel was very entertaining on the way, his way out the door.
Right, right.
Because they basically took, you know, smile, he even made fun of smiling Diesel and stuff like that. And, you know, he just said what he wanted. He was pretty funny.
Yeah, and it's not like The Undertaker at that time had the capacity on a regular basis to carry a work rate show Kevin Nash.
He was still very
He had to be carried, and so did Nash.
Yeah, he was still very in the gimmick. But this match was not bad.
But that's what I'm saying.
It's been years since I haven't watched this show in a long time.
This match was surprisingly acceptable, clearly. Yeah. Then the other one, and you and I have kind of differed on this in the past on how good it was, the Hollywood Backlot Brawl in 12-15, Roddy Piper defeated Goldust with Marlena.
Marlena was so hot during this period, by the way.
She was. This was before New Jack and any of the other stuff. But, I could have done without the White Bronco Chase parody.
You could have done without that?
I'll concede that much to you, Kyle.
Yeah, here, let me quote. You know, I've seen this before. Thank you, Vince.
But, I mean, as far as just good stiff shots being exchanged
and
everything like
that. The brawling was okay.
For a garbage match, I thought it was really good.
But it was so dumb the way it was. Like, they started brawling.
They build up to it. They do the brawling,
and then they do the chase, and then, like, they have another match. I think it's, like, Austin Vega. And then they're like, wait a minute, they're back in the building. And I didn't like this. Goldust was... by the way, originally this was supposed to be Razor Ramon, but he made this big, my kids don't want to see me getting beat up by, a gay guy on TV.
Right.
Come on, Scott.
Wasn't it also that he was suspended then for a drug test? As soon as they gave his notice, they...
Kind of one hand watched the other in this one. You know, right. It was a kind of a person, so he was out. So they brought Piper in to do it, and there were some good promos involved, and I thought Dustin Rhodes did a hell of a job during this period.
You know what? You know what they needed to do?
He was getting really... It wasn't as shameless as the artist formerly known as Goldust period. Nothing could ever rival that for shamelessness.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, I remember shortly after that famous mouth-to-mouth angle with Ahmed Johnson, which is so funny, when Owen Hart was lecturing, what you're seeing here is very standard CPR.
Right.
Yeah, and... it was just funny, Ahmed waking up, it was whatever.
The last note that I have on this one is...
But this was just, I don't know, it was silly.
If they're going to do the White Bronco angle, they needed to go all the way with it, all right? If they're doing the whole thing of, you know, they're showing the shots of the cars or whatever, they need to have somebody, like, phone into the thing that's supposed to be an eyewitness thing, but it's the Baba Booey guy. They needed to go all the way with it, Kyle. Recreate everything from that night.
Dennis Rodman was originally supposed to be in this. And WCW signed him away.
Dennis Rodman, what they could have done, too, is, they really should have gone all the way with it. You go to a split screen so it's there, and then in another frame you've got John Starks clinking a bunch of three-point shots off the rim.
There you go.
There's all kinds of ways to improve it.
It took me a second to realize what the hell you were talking about.
Yes, exactly. June 17th, 94, yo. So
that's a great documentary.
Yeah.
By your favorite channel.
It is. And I look forward, as I mentioned during a previous one, to the sequel, September 13th, 1993. I hope ESPN Films is working on that sometime soon.
Yeah, not interesting enough. Not mainstream enough. Were the Yankees involved in any way?
Yeah. Not enough storylines. It was the Cleveland Browns after all that night and not the New York Yankees.
Well,
so
then who cares?
Well... there are more Browns backers clubs nationwide than worldwide than for any other NFL team. Kyle Ross,
I don't give a damn about the bone lady.
All right, well,
that slut.
where do you slot 12 before we
dead middle?
All right, dead middle.
Twelve is dead middle.
All right.
As a matter of fact, the middle ones, I said this literally could be the one right in the middle.
I differ in the sense that I am going to give this a Jim Abbott two thumbs up. So
I kind of give it one thumbs up and one in the middle.
Okay. WrestleMania 13 now, our last one to look at here for the mini episode. The next year, emanating from Chicago, the aforementioned Rosemont Horizon.
Yeah, we never mentioned, by the way, the last one was in the pond at Anaheim.
Yeah.
Again, not not the Pontiac Silverdome.
No, it was not. It takes a lot for the Rosemont Horizon to be potentially a step up. But it may have been just because Chicago.
Well, just because Chicago's big city, you know. I mean, but, the class city of the Midwest, okay? The Cubs, the Bulls, okay? And a bunch of jabroni teams like Milwaukee, okay?
Thank you, Tom Thibodeau. Okay, but yes. We come to this one here.
Better than Market Square Arena.
That's true. This was a one-match show, but not the one that was anticipated to be.
Well, I think from a work perspective,
we knew that,
those in the know knew what could deliver.
But in terms of importance, you didn't know how important it was going to be. It was a
rematch. It wasn't even supposed to happen. First of all, the of any WrestleMania in history.
Yeah.
So the interest was down, and the main event sucked. And the undercard sucked.
Right.
And there was no level of interest. The level of interest was at an all-time low.
Sean lost his smile. We were in a whole streak WrestleMania where the next year it would be a new babyface in the main event.
Okay.
Yeah.
The company, look, here's the big thing. Mm-hmm. Let's start that back because I stammered. Can you just edit that last minute out, by the way? The last thing of me just scrambling, wondering, what am I going to say? I was distracted. I didn't know what the hell was going on.
We had a minor issue with the system, but it appears to have snapped back.
Okay, so. Good. To me, to start to tell the story here, you have to go back to July of 96.
Yeah.
Bash the Beach, WCW.
Right.
NWO. For the first time ever, no one is considering the WWF the number one wrestling promotion in this country.
Right.
Well, at least in the national expansion era. The NWO takes off. Sean was not a great champion. He was behaving very poorly behind the scenes.
And if by behind the scenes you include in the ring and yelling at Vader unprofessionally, then I agree with you.
Well, you know, you need to get in the proper position for his moonsaults, okay? All right. And then
there could be consequences to not catching people. Yes, sincerely, Miz.
Yes, yes. Now, Brett came back at the Survivor Series to face a guy who was kind of an afterthought at WrestleMania 12. And had transformed himself into quite the big deal, Mr. Steve Austin.
Mm-hmm.
They have a wonderful match, 4 3/4 stars. I think it's the best match in the history of the Survivor Series. And from there, the build is to do the Brett Shawn rematch. You know, we talked about how they didn't do the Hogan Warrior rematch. The plan here was to do Brett and Shawn. And I learned from the Brett Shawn DVD that it was never scheduled to be the world title match. It was always Vince had panicked again and went with the big guys. You've referenced this.
Footnote.
Okay,
yeah.
I didn't know that. I always assumed that, you know, when Sean lost, I don't know how they were going to do it. Maybe they were wrong or lying. I don't know. But the bottom line is this, okay? Sean loses the belt to Sid when he probably should have lost to Vader a couple months early. He wins it back at the Alamo Dome in the Rumble, loses his smile, basically leaves, is kind of, and the company gets rightfully pissed. Adam, you know, when we say lose a smile, most people know that we're referencing it. People,
right.
You know, a lot of people accuse him of exaggerating a knee injury, so he did not have to drop the title to Bret Hart. He winds up not dropping the title to anybody. He just forfeits it in the ring, you know, and it winds up at the end of the day on Sid. And the plan was, because that WrestleMania was called Heat, that it was going to be Bret and Shawn, you know, with this big rematch it was going to be. And it doesn't come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
They write Shawn out of the program. Brett has nothing to do. So they kind of sort of resuscitate the Steve Austin program. And it was Brett made it seem like it was kind of like in the DVD. He seemed real bitter that it was kind of like a dead and foregone issue. I didn't view it that way. I remember
Austin cheated to win the Royal Rumble.
Yeah, and that was Austin's kind of main pro. Like, Austin the whole time after that was always campaigning for another shot at
right.
Bret Hart. So I didn't think it was as dead an issue as Brett made it out to be. And it obviously, the moral of the story is, of this whole soliloquy, is it winds up working out for the better. Now, the WrestleMania 13, along with one, is one of the hardest WrestleManias to rate for me. I still give it below average designation because I think you have to, because mm-hmm. the level of interest was so low and every match but one is bad.
That's true.
But, we do have the greatest match in the history of the company, and I would argue maybe the greatest match in the history of the business. With Bret and Steve Austin, with this is the when you trace things back, the identifiable point where Steve Austin's career truly took off. Because, yeah, okay, you can talk about the Austin 316 promo, King of the Ring, previous year. He wasn't even working pay-per-view. He wasn't even working the main show at SummerSlam.
Right.
So this is where he turned, you know, they do the impossible double turn. And I'll say this about this match, its legacy. In a year that saw the first Hell in a Cell, Shawn Undertaker, the Eddie Ray match, WCW Halloween Havoc, which is a lot of people, including myself, consider to be the best WCW match of the 90s. This was considered the match of the year at the end of 97.
Mm-hmm.
That was before. You know, Austin's career was kind of still a little, you know, okay, he's not 100%, you know. They're going to make him into the guy. Hopefully that works. It's only after that, then, that adds to it. It's like I said, this is the traceable point where Steve Austin's career takes off. So to me, that's such a mark in this match's favor that even before you knew that Steve Austin would become the biggest draw in the history of the company, this was considered the match of the year.
It was.
And it is, you know, I referenced, you know, we kind of talked about three of the four-star matches, three of the four five-star matches in WrestleMania history. This would be the tops of all time. This is number one. There has not been a five-star match at WrestleMania since this. Time.
Right, because when you looked at him coming out of WrestleMania,
he was just such a star.
Yes, I mean, a huge star. For the first time, it was okay to cheer for him now that they'd executed the double turn. But this was the last thing that he had needed to get to this level. A few things
they
came
needed
before
to make it official.
King of the Ring the year before, and the Austin 316 chants and signs that started right thereafter. The whole thing, as you said, the match at Survivor Series with Bret Hart,
That was his best match ever.
It was a sequential thing in that instance. Even going back to, I believe, in that match, even though it had been months since he left Ted DiBiase, DiBiase had left the promotion. He reverted during that match to using the $1 million dream, which he would also use subsequently, interestingly enough, at WrestleMania 17 in the heel turn match against The Rock.
Yes.
Which was very interesting. But, this was like the last piece of the puzzle that Austin needed to become a megastar. He had the other things that were setting it up over the course of the previous year. This match with the explosive double turn, he never tapped out, even though it was a submission match.
He
passed out in the sharpshooter, and Ken Shamrock was the third man in the ring.
That's always kind of the forgotten part of this match, that Ken Shamrock was brought in.
Well, I asked him about it when he was on the show in the fall. We spent some time talking about this, and it was an interesting thing. It was the wedge for Ken Shamrock, storyline-wise.
To get into WWE.
He'd been a cage fighter in UFC previously. Went on to, I thought, a really pretty good run in the company. Here's the thing, too. I told you last year, I believe on my birthday, I finally got around to watching Canadian Stampede for the first time. Just a side note, I couldn't believe it didn't seem like, especially against Pillman or whatever, it didn't seem like Shamrock got nearly as much offense as you would think badass MMA fighter would get.
Well, you know, he's new, he's green, he doesn't know what he's doing. I love, by the way, when him and Pillman are fighting, that Pillman starts like tapping his arm out of the ground. That makes me laugh.
Yeah,
I love Brian Pillman. Pillman's got this look on his face like, look what I'm doing,
Yeah. But it was like, I couldn't.
That wasn't his crowd, that wasn't his night.
It sort of took me out of it a little bit because a badass like Ken Shamrock in real life doesn't get bitched out the way that
did in that match. Honestly, though, that was Steve Austin's four throwaway baby faces that night. But look, with Vin, they did such a great job building to this that makes me say that it's so amazing that this wasn't even on the books originally.
Yeah. Fell ass backwards into it.
Yes. And look, they were, I could argue that going into the show, they were at their low point, getting their tail kicked by WCW.
Yeah.
The ratings say that was even later in the year, kind of when Bret was leaving, that was when the gap was the widest.
Right.
I've always felt personally that the end of 96 through the beginning of 97 was when the gap was truly at its biggest.
Yep.
Going when there was no one really that would argue that WCW wasn't the better promotion. You know, Mick Foley said on a lot of interviews, it's like, look, you know, yeah, it took us till, you know, April 98 to overtaking the ratings, but I always felt we were the better show for a while before that, and he's absolutely correct.
Yes.
You know, I thought it was getting pretty even in the summer.
Yes,
and
they got better. This was the end of their creative nadir.
Yeah. I mean, 96, you know, actually, to be honest, I could argue that the end of 96, when the NWO was just red hot and new and really going, that was probably when WCW was at its, you know, the gap was biggest. But it was still big here anyway, regardless.
And I know you disagree with me, but I feel the NWO is getting stale in the summer and the fall of 97. I know you'll throw metrics at me and say that the numbers don't back that up, but
no, I would have, the fall,
I was looking at it like creatively. Anyways, I was looking at it like, okay, enough already.
Well, they should have been killed dead at Starrcade 97, and they should have done the split, the Wolfpack Hollywood thing right after that. That was mishandled.
I still thought that it was just way too long of a drag out to Sting Hogan.
Oh, I didn't. I thought that was well done, and it's all their fault why that didn't work. Okay, it's not because they waited. It's not because they waited why that didn't work. It's because Hulk Hogan is a selfish prick. Okay,
true.
With a hideous orange tan, and he needed to shave his head years ago.
I agree with all that, but you know, and
what
also,
do you got to say about that?
I think he also needs to stop getting caught by paparazzi cameras giving reach arounds to his daughter. I think that would be helpful also if he would.
Excuse me. Okay. Yes.
Haven't you seen those?
No.
They're kind of hot, actually. I'm not going to lie.
Okay. Jesus. Oh God.
But I just want to
back
see, like,
to WrestleMania 13.
You. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
They did a good job. You know, Vince McMahon, who is much maligned on play-by-play. This was, by the way, the only WrestleMania where it was Vince, JR, and the King. I loved them together, by the way.
Yeah.
I thought Vince as the storyline play-by-play guy mixed in with JR as the knowledge play-by-play was a
right.
Good, I thought they worked well.
And this was post-heel JR. The previous fall, JR had been a little bit of a heel.
Yeah, Vince had kind of taken the muzzle off JR, so to speak, and let him kind of do his spiel. You know, he let him work in all the football references and all the, you know, the slobber knockers and the, you know, and whatever.
By God!
Yeah, you know.
Shades of when he was playing Pop Warner there as a king.
And they did such a – I remember – you know, they talked about it. Like, Vince, I don't know why they're cheering this Austin, but they sure do. They did such a great job on commentary of setting this whole thing up.
It was a slow burn. It was beautiful.
It really was. And, you know, you have to talk about the Raw the week before when Brett went off with that profanity-laden tirade,
right,
which was so incredible.
The groundwork was laid excellently.
Yes. This was – it was so perfect that it pretty much washes away all the crap. I would never recommend it's interesting. I would never recommend watching this WrestleMania. Now Brett Shawn's on there. I would just recommend watching Brett Austin.
Yeah.
If you have it on a comp or something like that, you know, just watch that.
Exactly.
Because the rest of this show is hideous. I mean, there are people who rate this as one of the worst WrestleManias ever.
I can understand that.
I can't go that far because how do you say something's one of the worst if it's got the best match ever?
Well, you said 2 5 stars at WrestleMania 10 carried it to a place in the Pantheon.
Yeah,
so.
well, that carried it. That also had, from a storyline perspective, I think put things in its right place. This had nothing else right except the most perfect match ever.
Right.
And that carries it. It's not the worst ever. It would be on the upper tier of the bottom 10.
The throwaways here on this card actually start with the ostensible main event and what was the build main event going into this thing here. The Undertaker defeating the champion Psycho Sid in a no disqualification match for the WWF Championship in 21-19.
Bad match.
Why you let those two guys work for 21-19, I'll never know.
Yeah.
Who's supposed to carry who here?
Yeah. The only cool thing here is that after the world title is bouncing around a lot. You had the Final Four. You had Sid beating Bret on a Raw. You had a lot of Undertaker gave some stability to that title when it needed it. You know, he holds it till SummerSlam.
And this match did have star power in that. You were conditioned to look at both of these.
It's funny.
Oh, he's a horrible
worker.
It's
funny that this was the second time Sid closed WrestleMania, and I could make an argument that they were the two worst closers.
It might very well have been, but that's Did Sid deserve to be a star? No. But did the masses...
He was kind of in that Luger-Bigelow level, too, of should have been better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But in what's even more apparent in his case...
Labeled as can't miss, and he missed.
Yeah, but it's less of a mystery in his case why he didn't do more, because he's not that good.
Yes.
And he also...
I can say the same about Luger.
Oh, Luger's a lot better than him.
Yeah.
Sure. Luger's way better. Sure. And Luger never quit playing to play softball, or quit wrestling to play softball, as he did on many different occasions.
And this was pretty much it for Sid, by the way, in WWE.
He
hung around for a little bit, and it was
Yeah, we barely knew you. The rest of the card here, just blowing through it. On the free-for-all, Billy Gunn defeated Flash Funk. Flash Funky Funky Flash, as New Jack, I think, once called him in a shoot interview in 705. Too Cold Scorpio, criminally underused in the WWF at the
time. This is a dark match, correct?
It was the free-for-all.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I missed that. All right.
The four-way tag team match to determine the number one contenders for the WWF Tag Team Championship. The Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher, defeated the New Blackjacks, Wyndham and Bradshaw. The Godwins.
Kid did not want their figures, their action figures.
The Godwins, Henry and Phineas, with Hillbilly Jim and Doug Furness and Phil LaFon. R.I.P. Doug Furness, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Great workers. Hands down, in this match, if we were going to look at who should have gotten it based on work rate, it would have been Furness.
They were still baby faces here, I think.
They were.
They had some good matches with Owen and Bulldog, who were the tag champs before this.
Right.
Just not over as a baby.
Barry Windham, an all-time Pantheon worker, been in a horrible tag team.
The New
here.
Blackjacks was one of the stupidest ideas.
Blackjack,
I've ever heard.
Bradshaw was way too sorry, JBL, but you were way too green at the time to be credible. And
I kind of thought the Headbangers deserved to go over. I remember at the time. I don't know why.
I would have preferred Furness and LaFon. I was starting to become a full-fledged smark at the time.
Yeah, well, they had already challenged them and kind of not been successful,
so
you knew they weren't going over.
That's true. Intercontinental title match, one of the ones that we will make fun of forever and a day. Rocky Maivia, the champion, defeated the
Blue Chipper.
Yes. He defeated the Sultan with Bob Backlund and the Iron Sheik in 9:45.
Okay, if you think Rocky sucks, okay, I raise you the Sultan. This match is obviously semi-infamous for being the debut of Rocky Sucks.
Yeah.
And Die Rocky Die was the famous sign that
right.
he would reference here. This is the nadir of the Intercontinental title.
Right.
Without question. They did some sort of half-hearted... Rocky was bad. I mean, there's no doubt. He was just bad at this point. And he was so bad that they jobbed him to Owen Hart shortly after this for the Intercontinental title and took him off TV. And then the rest is history.
You know, when you're the champ in a match... And you come backstage after the match, and Bob Backlund says to you, "Wow, that's the wrong kind of heat, son, for a champion. That's pretty bad, man. Pretty bad."
And they put all the focus here on like the old timers, because you know you had Backlund and Sheik. Yeah, that they were trying desperation.
That was the legacy that they were going to get.
And Rocky Johnson saves Rocky, and like Rocky Johnson, look to me. I mean, well, now it's clear. I mean, his kind of, first line on Wikipedia is the father of The Rock, okay?
Right.
I mean, he was a former tag team, but he wasn't like a major star, I thought.
Nowhere near Backlund and the Sheik, no question about it. Hunter Hearst Helmsley, he'd come a long way since jobbing to the Warrior in a squash the previous year. Triple H with China defeated Goldust.
Although
he
still sucked at this period.
Yeah, 14-28, another instance of giving way too much time to a match that didn't deserve it.
These were like two former Intercontinental champions. Goldust was a terrible babyface in 1997.
Yeah, no way capable of carrying Triple H.
And Triple H, though, I'll say this, he goes over, he began to get heat because of China here.
Right.
He began to get heat because of China.
Yeah, he certainly did. Tag team title match.
It'd be amazing. A year later, all of a sudden, finally, things would start to click.
Yes, they would.
No pun intended.
Exactly. Owen Hart and the British Bulldog, the tag team champions, fought Mankind and Vader with Paul Bearer to a double countout in 16:08. Just a real head-scratching thing here that I understand. I believe that Mick Foley, I think he was quoted in one of his books as saying, that he had pitched it to Vince about somehow acknowledging the backstory with Vader, and Vince just didn't want to hear it because it didn't happen there. I mean, how you put those two guys together and don't even acknowledge, Excedrin number 9 or whatever, I don't understand it.
Well, I mean, that doesn't surprise me. More to me, the story of this is always that Vader and Mankind were supposed to get the titles. Bret Hart pulled creative control because they were reforming that. They would obviously reform the Hart Foundation very shortly after this. And he wanted Owen and Davey still strong. Because the thing was, they were going to lose, and they were the original plan was Owen and Davey to split up. Davey was going to go face. Brett, you know, kind of went all things, was like, no, we're not doing that. I want a big heel group.
I blow hot and cold on Mick Foley's shtick, but I got to admit, I've just gained new respect from that. He walked out in support of Bret Hart 6 months later after something like that. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it didn't hurt his career that much.
No, it didn't, but I still am amazed by that. And then the only other one we haven't talked about thus far, the six-man tag team Chicago Street Fight. The Legion of Doom, Hawk and Animal, and Ahmed Johnson.
Clearly
the
second best match on the show.
Yeah, Crush, Farouk, and Savio Vega with Wolfie D, J.C. Ice, D'Lo Brown, and Clarence Mason. The whole thing, too, this was fatally crippled by the whole thing of why in God's name they ever had Ahmed Johnson join the Nation and then feud with them again. I mean, this Farouk put him out of friggin' wrestling, and he comes back and joins them.
It was, well, here's the thing. I can comment on that in a second.
Yeah.
I thought, for a visual, when Ahmed Johnson cut, like, you know, the Road Warriors step out first, and then Ahmed comes out next, and he's got the Road Warrior spikes on.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
That's
This is actually a pretty cool match. This was a hot feud. Now, it's interesting. Ahmed, they teased he had gang roots. He was becoming lazy during this period.
Right.
He had hit his peak a year previous. They turned him heel. Now, you know why they turned him back babyface, don't you?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, when they turned him heel, Ahmed was always a scary-looking dude, man.
Mm-hmm.
They were afraid at the period, and it kind of was that Ahmed was usurping Farouk's heat as the leader of the group.
Okay.
So they wanted to put in a far less offensive and what they felt far more minimal heat-drawing guy to take Ahmed's spot. How interesting that would be Rocky Maivia, who would, of course, take way more of Farouk's heat away than Ahmed ever could have, and winds up booting Farouk out of the group and becoming the leader and, of course, becomes one of the greatest stars in this industry.
I am flashing back to my WOUB days in Athens. And now you know the rest of the story. Thank you, Kyle.
That is what I believe. They put Ahmed in, and the dynamic wasn't working because people kind of viewed him and Farouk as equals. It just wasn't working. So they're like, well, you know, Rocky Maivia, we still believe in him. God, did he suck. We'll just stick him in the Nation. You know, God knows, you know, no one will view him as equals of Farouk after that disastrous run. And you know, the rest, as they say,
why they would have put Ahmed in there in the first place, was that made no sense. It was completely nonsensical storyline.
Well, I don't know. They did tease it. I mean, I remember when it happened, I was not shocked. I saw it coming a million miles away.
That just seemed like a Russo thing. Swerve for the sake of swerve. The guy who put the guy out.
Yeah, and it's like, why? Like, really, after you've said all these, like, why would you? They didn't really do a good job of explaining it. And
the
funny thing is that I think, like, Ahmed got injured anyway right after he did it. So,
right.
But, yeah, it was, you know, and then by after that, when they, you know, when you turn him back babyface and do the same thing, the heat's gone. And it was all gone.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, Ahmed's trajectory before that first injury, when he was tag teaming with Sean as the People's Posse, when he was the Intercontinental Champion, you know.
You thought this guy was going to be one of the great stars. I remember I was like the last person to give up on Ahmed Johnson. Like, I remember, like, I would always, like, call that old Plain Dealer hotline. You remember that thing?
Black Jack Brown?
Yeah, and I was like, when's Ahmed Johnson coming back from injury? Got it. They could really use Ahmed right now. And it just, he never did.
You were all hyped for him when he won the letter T from Booker T.
Yeah.
Years later.
You're going down. By the way, Marcellus Wiley, I believe, is Ahmed Johnson's twin.
Marcellus Wiley is somebody that I loathe.
Oh, why? Because he works for ESPN?
Well, also because he's a backstabber, because of this is a guy who made disparaging comments about Rob Johnson when in support of Doug Flutie there. He was insubordinate towards his starting quarterback, and I didn't appreciate that. He was campaigning for this fraudulent Doug Flutie.
Oh, now get out of town.
The one of my least favorite players ever, the midget mullet. in favor of Rob Johnson, who was completely fatally undermined by that cabal in Buffalo that Marcellus Wiley was a proud part of. I absolutely believe
that. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I absolutely believe that.
Rob Johnson stinks.
Rob Johnson,
a
man who could scramble barefoot and throw a touchdown pass, and did on occasion, by the way. Rob Johnson,
what's he doing now, running around the backyard, scrambling barefoot?
One of the least utilized fine quarterbacks of this past generation. We may never know, had he not been fatally backstabbed and compromised by Doug Flutie in Buffalo, what he would have gone on to do. We may never
know. Give me Flutie flakes. Remember when Jimmy Johnson like stomped on that box of Flutie flakes?
Flutie, even I was going,
whoa, Doug, like you took it the wrong way. Like he's like, he just stomped on autistic children everywhere. It's like, whoa, geez. Moving on to the AFC South.
to which a former colleague of ours, Eric Stranko, would probably reply, if only if that were literally true.
Oh, now come on. All I can say is, Rob Johnson could go to hell.
Oh, Doug Flutie can stick it, brother.
I like it.
All right, well, we're feeling punchy here at this point, but WrestleMania 13, so how do you slot it ultimately?
In the bottom 10. But barely. It's right below the average group.
All right. So it gets carried like the Samsonite it is, up from being the dregs because of the Bret Austin.
Yeah, it's kind of in the middle. It's kind of the lower, yeah.
All right. Well, this is chapter six here of this gone by. The middle part of the trilogy here that we have tackled here today. Parts 4, 5, and 6 in this marathon taping. 4, 5, and 6 almost to the letter, as long as 1, 2, and 3 were a combined 4.5 hours. Truly, truly unbelievable.
Yes.
Only we can bring it this way, but the Kyle Ross 9-part history of WrestleMania anthology.
We talked about at the beginning how whoever told the Ultimate Warrior not to run to the ring did a great job because he didn't sure he got blown up. I'm blown up now.
I am too.
I'm blown up.
All I can say
we got to go home, brother. Time to go home.
Shades of that night in Miami. I'm going to need to do like Kellen Winslow and get some IVs and some bananas. Stat. We'll wrap it on that note. This has been part 6 of Kyle Ross's 9-part history of WrestleMania anthology. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross breaking it down for you.